For the week of December 30th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 175, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And back in New York, I'm Michael Gills.
Back in New York, where were you?
Well, I was in Allentown, Pennsylvania for the holidays.
Spent
the day with my family, putting them to bed by about 8 or 9 o'clock, and then I'd go out to a movie.
Okay. So when you did that, on the drive over to the theater, did you sing, "And I'm spending time here in Allentown for Christmas," or "I'm living here in Allentown," that Billy Joel song?
I did not, but I should have.
Yeah. Well, okay. How was your Christmas?
It was great. We're recording on New Year's Eve, so I'm getting ready to go out and see Zero Dark Thirty, and then I'm going to come home and watch some other classic films. I'm not saying Zero Dark Thirty is a classic. I haven't seen it yet. But every year, my Christmas New Year's Eve tradition is to try and pick two or three great movies that I've never seen, you know, movies that have a great reputation that I'm pretty sure I'll like, and watch them. That's my New Year's Eve tradition. I make sure I start the new year with at least one great film.
Okay. So this year it's going to be which film?
I have a couple. I haven't decided yet. It might be one of the trilogy by Vida, Ashes and Diamonds. It might be The Asphalt Jungle by John Huston, or Floating Weeds by Ozu, or The River by Renoir. I'm focusing on the 1950s because I'm coming up with a list of the best movies of the decade for that decade with my friends in my film club, the IRIS.
Okay. Well, maybe we can talk about some of the movies that you saw in Allentown over the Christmas holiday. When we discuss box office, and we will, well, on today's show, we'll be talking about other things. And in fact, we'll be telling you the most bankable movie stars in the world, who they are, at least according to Forbes. We'll also tell you the latest films to be entered into the National Film Registry, Michael, here in the United States. And maybe some of the films from the 1950s that you're watching will be listed.
3D, one of them is.
I know. Yeah, that's why I thought it might. Well, now, Michael, this next one you're going to love. 3D might be dead, according to the BBC.
Yay!
Though not according to the Queen of England. We'll discuss some of the top Broadway shows of the year, at least according to Michael, and fill you in on which production is happy to say it's in the black. No, it's not. Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. That's getting way too easy to do, by the way. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gills to fill us in on the weekend's box office. And he's going to begin with a gripe about international box office grosses.
That's right. Sadly, even though it's been 2 weeks since we've done a box office roundup, there's no information on international releases. Everybody's on holiday overseas.
Literally, there's like nothing. I tried to find some from my regular sources, which are all overseas sources, like Screen Digest and Screen Daily. And I thought I had solved it, Michael. You asked me, you sent me a text message saying, hey, try and find some of these international numbers for me. And usually I'm pretty good at it. And I went to all my sources and I got really excited when I saw some. And then I realized, oh, I'm looking at the box office grosses for December 14th through the 16th.
Yeah, so everything we looked at, we could not get figures this week or really even last week. So we're way behind an international box office. Hopefully next week we'll record on Monday or Tuesday. We'll have a big catch up and find out how a lot of these movies are doing around the globe. But we're going to do North American box office because that's all we have available right now. Of course, there's a lot to say because it's been the holiday season here in North America, at least. Those 10 or 12 days around Christmas and New Year's are the most profitable 12 days of the entire year for movie going. Everyone has off from work. Everyone has off from school. And everyone wants to go to the movies.
I guess that's why, literally, I have sat next to some of the rudest people in the world over the past week.
They're just not experienced at going to the movies?
No, they seem to think that you get to talk to your neighbors, even if you don't know them, all through the movie, or even sing along in certain cases.
Okay. Oh, Les Mis. All right. Well, here we go. So here are the top movies in North America for the weekend right before New Year's Eve. So we're catching up. We missed Christmas week, which is a huge week. The weekend before and Christmas Day are some of the biggest days of the year. A lot of big movies opened up. So it's going to take a little bit of time, I think. Number one at the box office is The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. It made another $32 million this weekend. It's now at $32 million.
Wow, okay.
It's at $222 million in North America. Worldwide, it's approaching $700 million. There was some concern, and we still have to see how it holds up next week if it drops off quickly. But there was some concern that because of the really bad reviews and the fact that it was not tracking quite as well as The Fellowship of the Ring, that this might prove to be a lot less durable than the other Lord of the Rings films. People were immediately saying this is not going to get anywhere near $1 billion, like the last one, The Return of the King. now it looks like, well, it's in good shape. It's showing good legs. So we'll have to see how it does long term, but it's certainly holding up well over these big holiday weeks. $32 million for its third weekend is pretty darn good. At number two is the Quentin Tarantino film Django Unchained. That grossed $30 million over the weekend. It's made $64 million so far. It's probably the least Christmassy movie ever to open on Christmas Day.
That is true, especially if you've seen it.
Les Mis beat it on Christmas Day, but it was a close call. And since then, Django has been catching up. It will probably surpass Les Mis overall. It is Quentin Tarantino's most expensive film to date. It cost $100 million to make, which is more than the $70 million they spent on Inglourious Basterds. If you liked Inglourious Basterds, I think you'll like Django Unchained. I found it terrifically entertaining. I think it's another very mature adult work, by if that's the right term. It feels like a new step forward for Quentin Tarantino. It and Inglourious Basterds really feel like adult films as opposed to just having fun with violence and all that sort of stuff. I mean, it's a very violent film. It's over the top. It's crazy. But I thought it was really terrific and sophisticated.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I watched the film and, I'm a big fan of Quentin Tarantino's early work. So his, Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown, I like those movies. And his dialogue is just stellar. But sometimes I just wonder, I'm like, why, I don't know. I leave his films sometimes just a little perturbed. I don't know why.
And did you with this?
Well, unlike Inglourious Basterds, which I thought, there were some scenes in there that just went on way too long and were completely superfluous. This I thought was a little bit tighter. I liked the characters. I don't know where they spent $100 million since
period.
Yeah, it's a period piece. But, the last third of the movie takes place in that one mansion. Which they probably had to build. I understand. It's a practical set. I liked it. Yes, I'd have to say I liked it, though I wasn't in love with it.
I loved it. It'll be on my best of the year list. No question about it. I thought Christoph Waltz, again, was terrific.
He was unbelievable. He is phenomenal, that guy.
He's very magnetic. And Jamie Foxx was great. It's the best role he's had in a long time. And it's a fantasy. It's a fantasy revenge film about slaves uprising and shooting their masters. And it's very enjoyable and silly. It ends with, people on a white horse and in beautiful dresses. And it's a fairy tale in a way, but very violent and curse-filled.
Yes. And I guess there's some controversy now over the use of the N-word.
No, there isn't.
Well, that was one of the lead stories on last night's news.
Somebody said that. So what? It doesn't make it true.
Okay.
There's no controversy. What word are you going to use if you're in slave times? If you're in the antebellum South, that's the word they used.
What do you think about Leonardo DiCaprio in his role?
I thought it was great. I thought everybody was great.
Yeah,
Leonardo DiCaprio
so
was
too.
Great. It's his best work in a while. Jamie Foxx is easily his best work since Ray, and I think it's a much better picture. Samuel L. Jackson is great.
But don't you think Samuel L. Jackson at this point is kind of playing a parody of himself?
What, a house slave?
No, just, the way he gets so angry and,
No. I thought this was a terrific role, terrific part. It's also a fantasy role because in public he's sort of the, knee-scraping slave, but then in private with Leonardo DiCaprio, he's sipping brandy and talking back to the guy, putting him in his place. It's just the whole movie is just this absurd spaghetti Western spin revenge fantasy. It's just nutty as all can be, but I think it's a very interesting, nuanced part with a lot of complex ideas behind it, given the era and the time and the who's making the film and the context of the movie and what they're doing. I think it's very rich. I think it's a very interesting film.
Many hat tips to Sergio Leone and the spaghetti Westerns. And, I agree with you. The cast was superb, except for one particular actor, Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, he wasn't that good, no.
Yeah, he should really stop that.
And number three in North America is Les Mis, which grossed $28 million. It had the highest opening day gross for a musical of all time. It had the second highest Christmas Day opening of all time, and it has grossed $67 million so far. It's probably going to pass $100 million. That's a tremendous amount of money for a musical. I think the highest grossing musical of all time in North America is Chicago, which grossed $160 million.
And is all that, I know you're going to kill me for saying this, but is all of that adjusted for inflation? Because I'm thinking of only one musical, and that is Sound
Chicago
of...
Chicago is not that long ago.
Well, no, right. Sound of Music is what I'm thinking
of. Sound of Music obviously would have sold many more tickets.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right, yeah, just wondering.
Sound of Music was the top grossing film of all time for a little while. It certainly sold bucket loads of tickets. No question about that. But we can't compare different eras. Number four is Parental Guidance, the film starring Billy Crystal and Bette Midler. It grossed $14 million. It's at $29 million and counting. For some reason, people are considering this a win, though to me it seems like it's a pretty soft win at that. At number five is Jack Reacher, the Tom Cruise film. It grossed $14 million. It's at $44 million in North America and counting. It cost $60 million to make, so it's not doing great so far, but it'll probably be a wash. I saw this film. And when they pulled a benefit showing of the movie that was going to benefit schools because of the tragedy at Sandy Hook. And I thought, well, that's just stupid. They're trying to benefit schools. Why would you yank this film? I just don't get it. I don't understand it. That's just they're being too sensitive. Then I actually saw the film, which begins with a mass shooting.
Yeah, so I was going to say, there's a good reason, having seen that, I can tell you why they pulled it, because it was going to show at Lincoln Center. It was a big glitzy affair in New York City, less than, you know, an hour away from Newtown. I think there's a reason they pulled it.
Yeah, now I understand. I actually thought it was pretty fun. The female lead is weak, but I thought it was sort of a fun throwback type movie. And number six is This Is 40, the Judd Apatow film, a spinoff from what?
It could be a spinoff from two things. A 40-year-old virgin. No, Knocked Up, I think.
Knocked Up, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Yes, it grossed $13 million. It's at $37 million in counting. Lincoln is still holding on. It made another $7.5 billion. It's at $132 million in North America. They say it cost $65 million to make, though I don't know how, because it too is a period film. It is one of Spielberg's highest grossing dramatic films of all time. If you take away the action films like Raiders and all that, if you look at the dramas that he's made, like Saving Private Ryan and War Horse, this is one of his big successes of all time. So it's a very successful film for Steven Spielberg.
You know, Samuel L. Jackson was quoted in the LA Times in a story about how these movies just have no ending. They just have three or four endings. And he was saying, I don't need to see the guy go to the theater. I don't need to see him dying on the bed. You know, why couldn't it just end?
Are you trying to imitate Samuel L. Jackson?
No, because why would I do that? He might come and kick my butt. But I think he's right about that, though. That, you know, it should have ended with him just walking down the hallway after saying that famous line, you know, I suppose it's time to go, though I'd rather stay. Why do we need to?
I don't think it should have ended there. It should have ended earlier with the passing of the 13th Amendment. That's what the film was about. Extra half hour showing the end of Lincoln's life. We didn't sign up for a biopic. It wasn't a biopic, but suddenly it became one, and they tacked on another half hour to the film. It was completely extraneous and unnecessary. But it's very successful, and it will be a big contender at the Oscars. And number eight is The Guilt Trip. That is the Seth Rogen, Barbara Streisand film. That's definitely one of the flops of the year. It grossed $6.7 million. It's now $21 million and will probably fall off a cliff. And number nine is Monsters, Inc., a 3D reissue by Pixar. That grossed $6.3 million. It's at $18 million, also quite a big disappointment.
Although $18 million, it's like finding $18 million.
It's not, because it costs money to convert it to 3D. It costs money to make prints. It costs money to distribute it around the country. It costs money to advertise it. And it was supposed to set up the Monsters, Inc. sequel, and instead everybody showed such indifference to it, it now makes it look kind of stupid.
Well, I was hoping you wouldn't bring up all those points, but now that you mention it, you're right.
At number 10 is Rise of the Guardians, which grossed $4.9 million. This is the holiday-themed animated film. It's made $90 million in North America, and now that the holidays are over, it too will probably fall off a cliff. It's basically done anyway, but now it'll really drop off, because movies about Christmas really don't do well after New Year's. At number 11 is Skyfall, the James Bond film, another $4.6 million. That's at $289 million in North America. More importantly, it's at $1 billion worldwide, the first Bond film to cross $1 billion. Also in the UK, it is the highest grossing film of all time.
That's right. I think it passed, what, 100 million pounds?
Yes.
Which is like $1 trillion. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not the highest grossing British film. It's not the highest grossing Bond film. It's the highest grossing film, period, in the UK. So that's a huge accomplishment. At number 12 is Silver Linings Playbook, then Life of Pi, Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn, Cirque du Soleil, Worlds Away, a feature film based on Cirque du Soleil, which did not work, and Wreck-It Ralph and Argo. Those are the last 5 or 6 movies in the top 17. They're all making over more than $1 million a week, but they're all sort of, you know, puttering along. Life of Pi is sort of fading out in North America. It's made $84 million so far. However, it's doing gangbusters overseas, especially in China, where it made, how much did it make in China? It made,
well, last count in the middle of December, it was over $84 million.
Yeah, it's made more than that now, obviously, because we're talking about it. It grossed, I have a note here somewhere about that. Where is that? Oh, I can't find it. I think it's made $100 million in China.
Well, it's made more than it has made in the U.S., which is, I think, only the second time that's occurred.
Right. The first one is the Titanic reissue, but that's because it wasn't available originally. The original Titanic wasn't seen widely in China, so it wasn't a very high bar. So the fact that Titanic in 3D made more money in China than the original film isn't saying much because it simply wasn't distributed that far. People didn't have the chance to see it. So this was really their first chance to see Titanic. This, Life of Pi, is a more direct comparison. You've got China and the U.S. showing basically at the same time, and it's grossed more than China. Why not? They got a lot more people.
Yeah.
So that's the weekend box office. I loved Django. I was pretty mixed on Les Mis. We talked about it before. I saw The Hobbit a second time in 2D just to see what that was like. I actually did go back to see that again. And if you're in the mood for a lean 70s type film, Jack Reacher is sort of fun.
Well, now, Les Mis, I loved Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune. And I loved his review. You should look it up on Rotten Tomatoes. It just says, the excerpt is, "I didn't like it." And this is the best review. I'm going to read this review by Sam Richardson. I don't know who that is. This is the best review of Les Mis that I read. He says, "Went to the movies with the wife. We saw this obscure movie I had never heard of, some French foreign film. They must have been giving away free tickets because the lines were out the door. Anyway, the movie starts and Wolverine is singing his guts out. Then Catwoman starts crying and singing, and it's all very moving. The only problem was the girl next to me, who had apparently read the book or something, starts singing along. It was very distracting. So Wolverine is on the run from the Gladiator because Catwoman had a baby at Borat's house, but now she wants Wolverine to care for her. Time skip, a bunch of kids get shot, and in the end, everyone died. 4 stars.
Okay.
You didn't think that's funny?
Not really.
No? Come on. No? No.
Actors who've played more than one role. It's amazing.
No, but they're all like superheroes and, I mean... No,
I get it.
No, no. You know, I, you know, so what are you, I mean, look, did you like the musical?
I loved it.
You loved it. Okay. So the music, you know, let's face it. It's classic music, classic.
Well, a lot of people don't like it. It was not a well-reviewed film when it opened.
You mean
it's always been a popular hit, Les Miserables.
You mean
it's
well-reviewed always, musical.
What did I say?
Film.
Oh, well, that's wrong. I meant to say musical. Yes, it was not a well-reviewed musical. It was a popular hit. It won a lot of Tonys, but it has never been a critic's darling. And, of course, all the other musicals by the team that is behind Les Mis are horrible. Miss Saigon is terrible. Martin Guerre, which I saw twice in Europe while they were trying to turn it into a hit, was sort of interesting but also not successful. They never did anything other than Les Mis as far as having a remotely critical and popular success. Miss Saigon was a big hit, but... pretty reviled critically and deservedly so. This is the only good show they've ever done. So it makes you put, when you put it in context, you go, gee, it makes you want to be a little less enthusiastic because you can see everything else they did was no good. So they got lucky this one time.
Well, you know, I went to school with Elaine Boubile's, I think it's Elaine Boubile, right? The lyricist.
One of them, yeah.
Yeah, and I went to school with his son. And
his wealthy son, I imagine.
Oh, my gosh. You don't even know the half of it. I mean, they were just like, you know, put that stack of $1 million bills over there. You know, it was just, it was remarkably unbelievable. In any case, you know, I saw the film, and I saw it in a great screening, and I thought the singing worked for the most part. You know, Hugh Jackman can belt out a tune. You know, he's got that.
I disagree.
Oh, really? You didn't think the live singing worked?
No, the live singing was fine, but I don't think Hugh Jackman has a big voice enough for Jean Valjean. Jean Valjean is like the Wotan of, you know, operas, of Broadway musicals. It's a huge, big part. You need a big, booming voice. And he has a small, thin, pleasant voice. I've seen him on stage several times.
So have I.
He became famous as a performer in a musical. You know, Oklahoma. I saw him as a solo show. I saw him do the Peter Allen show. I think he's very charismatic, far more charismatic on stage than he's ever been on film. Nobody's
he really
captured.
Is. He really. Yeah. I saw The Boy from Oz too, and he really is more charismatic on stage than he is on film.
Oh, by times 10, easily. But he has a pleasant voice. He's a thin, small, pleasant voice. He can perform and perform a role. I saw him sing Soliloquy from Carousel, and that's a very challenging song, and he did it very well because he was acting his way through it. But he's just not the right voice for Jean Valjean. Jean Valjean is a huge, booming, singing role. You know, you've got to have a big voice, and he doesn't have it. Russell Crowe can't sing at all.
Oh, unbelievable. People are just, you know, I listened to people on the way out because I wanted to see it with an audience. I went and saw it with an audience, and boy, oh boy, I mean, they thought he was actually pretty good.
right? Well, and he sings in a rock band, but he does not have a good voice, and he certainly doesn't have a Broadway voice.
No.
What's her name? Helena Bonham Carter and Sacha Baron Cohen. Again, they can't sing. And their parts,
they don't really need to sing for their parts.
Well, it's a comic song, but you know what? Performed by a great performer, it's a lot better than what they did.
Well,
it isn't
okay.
A demanding part vocally, but they're just not singers and performers. So they didn't do a very good job. She didn't do a good job in Sweeney Todd either. Up and down the line, except for the girl who was carried over from the last London production or touring production who played
Eponine.
Other than her, almost nobody could sing. Well, that's a problem.
Yeah, but I mean, it's funny
because a problem.
I wondered, it's like, why do you cast Russell Crowe in this role? And I thought, well, because you need big,
they want
heavy
big stars.
Yeah, you need stars. Anne Hathaway, getting a lot of buzz for this.
Well, she'll get an Oscar nomination, if not win the Oscar. She was, as I said, if you were going to have actors, stars in these roles, you could accept one person who couldn't really sing, but somehow acted their way through a part. That would be acceptable for one of the roles. If she was the only one and everybody else could actually sing, then that would work in context. But since everybody is a weak singer, then that makes it less acceptable to me. But what she does, she's more effective than all the others as far as the Hollywood stars are going. But again, that song, Patti LuPone, you put her up next to Patti LuPone singing that song from the original Broadway production, forget about it.
Well,
LuPone knocks that out of the – well, but that's a great – it's a musical. You want to have it performed well, don't you? What do you mean, oh, that's not fair? Compare it to the Broadway singers?
Well, they're different mediums.
Fair.
They're different mediums.
No, they're not. You got to be able to sing.
Well,
you got to be able to sing. You can't
sing.
Well,
let me ask you this. Do you think that shooting the – because this film was shot by Tom Hooper and he had the – he basically used live music. He used the voice.
He had them sing on stage. Right. They recorded their vocals live. Instead of mouthing the lyrics and then recording them in a studio later, they actually sang the songs. Right. They actually sang the songs or vice versa. All right. Before. Yeah. They sang the songs on stage while they were performing in front of the cameras.
Right.
That was a perfectly good choice, absolutely.
Right. I guess that choice was good, but then I look at some of the other choices.
You just need to have singers.
Well, okay, so that's the singing and that's the vocal part, but then I look at this was a big, grand musical that's sweeping and goes across the decades, and then he decides to shoot it from the vantage point of, I don't know what he thought, like a fly or something, because he is so darn close to everybody's face. The best thing I read about it, the best critique of that I read, I think came from Michael Phillips. He said he was staring up their noses so closely, all the actors' noses so closely for so long, he thought he was going to catch a cold.
I actually thought that was sort of interesting, his approach to the movie. My friend Aaron is now screaming that I'm an idiot. The play, the musical, rather famously on Broadway and in London where it began, or actually in France it began, but it brought cinematic techniques to the theater like never before. I'm sure it wasn't the first show to use a turntable, but it made a turntable on stage sort of de rigueur for musicals for a long time. It was exciting. You would have a scene where Jean Valjean, like in the film, where he says, I can't let this man go to jail for my crimes. He's being unjustly accused of being me. And on stage, boom. The next second, he's in front of the judge. You're like, wow, it's like this great theatrical trick. He's walking and talking and singing, and suddenly the stage just turns, and boom, there he is in front of the judge. And it was like a scene cut in a film, but on stage, and it was kind of exciting. In the movie, cutting from one location to another is boring. So that's not very interesting. So what he said was the stage production became as cinematic as possible. So what he did for the film production was to try to make it as theatrical as possible. He said, I'm going to have the people sing live. I'm going to go in close because you can't do that in a stage production. So he tried to sort of bring something new to it to sort of counter what the differences was for the medium. I thought that was sort of an interesting idea. It wasn't executed well enough because he didn't have good enough performers. But and I don't agree with where he placed the camera every time
That became
but
part,
I have no problem with a close-up in a musical performance. Certainly not Anne Hathaway. There's nothing wrong with that at all.
Well, and where he placed the camera became such a big deal because it was so close. If it wasn't that close, I mean, you could kind of cheat it a bit. And how many out-of-focus shots do we need? It was, and all of the spectacle of the master of the house scene where, there's supposed to be all of the, basically people flying off the rafters.
It was a mess.
Yeah, I mean, you're so close that you're like, oh, so you basically have all of these extras and hundreds of extras. And we get to see Sacha Baron Cohen and Helena Bonham Carter really up close. And then you cut it like a rock video. Okay,
so,
thanks.
So we didn't like Les Mis, and that guarantees it will win Best Picture.
No, you know what? I did like Les Mis, but I had
you
problems with
You just said 18 things you had problems with.
Well, yeah, now that you mention it. But I liked it.
One big thing talking about the Oscars is Zero Dark Thirty. It's still in limited release. It's going to open wider on January 11th, but it's been doing gangbuster business. One thing really annoyed me. The Hollywood Reporter said that Zero Dark Thirty opened to a record-breaking $124,000 in 5 theaters in New York and L.A., the top showing of all time for a limited release, debuting on Wednesday.
How many qualifiers were there?
Except for The Lion King.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm like, well, wait a second. Then it's not a record breaking. It's not the top showing of all time. It's the second top showing of all time. And you're like,
and if you're going to compare it to something, try not to compare it to a movie that opened 18 years prior with lower ticket prices
and still crushed it. Yeah, exactly. So it's like, I hate when they do that. They do that. They make exceptions for animated films, or they say, well, except for that one, because that, well, then it's not the highest. But anyway, that really annoyed me. But the big thing for Zero Dark Thirty is that the head of the CIA and several top senators all came out and chastised the film for implying that torture helped capture Osama bin Laden. Congress just released a report, and we've known for a while now that, according to people at the CIA and in the White House, that the torture of the prisoner who gave up information leading to Osama bin Laden, the information was achieved before they began torturing him. So it's been in the historical record for quite a while that, no, torturing did not help us track down Osama bin Laden. And now Congress has just put out an official report putting that into black and white terms. I can't remember the head of the CIA ever commenting on any film. And they weren't talking about the film as a film, but they were saying, look, this film implies that torture helped us capture Osama bin Laden. That's simply not factually true. They shouldn't have done that. They should make clear that this film is fiction. And the film is trying to, you know, it tells a complicated story in 2 hours and 40 minutes. And they say, hey, we didn't mean to, we're not implying that torture led to it. We're trying to capture the nuance and the gray areas of all of this, but blah, 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 blah. People in the Senate and the CIA say, excuse me, if you see the film, you think we tortured people and that helped us capture Osama. And that's not true.
No, we tortured people. Oh, and by the way, we killed Osama bin Laden. It just so happens we did both things. Yeah.
Yes, but one did not lead to the other.
Right. But the CIA guy, the head of the CIA, acting head of the CIA, was saying that, oh, that's not how we do things. No.
They were not denying that torture took place.
They don't. And by the way, they don't call it torture. They call it enhanced interrogation.
It depends, because some of this occurred in other countries by other governments. So it is torture. And no, it has been denounced as torture by the Obama administration. And they have renounced the practices that were done. They don't waterboard people anymore and pretend it's legal, because it's been illegal for decades. And our country itself has executed people for committing such war crimes, including Japanese soldiers. No, we do not play games anymore. The Obama administration has not continued those tactics. They may continue some other tactics that people disagree with that they think constitute torture, but a lot of it has been rejected by the current administration. So he's not playing games. He didn't say we've never tortured people. We did torture people. We broke international law. People should be in jail, and they're not. But the head of the CIA today is saying whatever torture we did not help us capture Osama bin Laden. There's a 1,000-page document just put out by Congress coming to that same conclusion. And so they're hitting this film and saying, you're misleading people into thinking torture helped us do this. And now this film, which is by liberal people in Hollywood, now has senators and the head of the CIA denouncing it. So welcome to the Oscar campaign. Because films love to criticize other films for their accuracy or their lack of whatever, this, that, perspective, anything they can do to sully the reputation of a film they love. Well, now you've got Congress and the CIA doing it for them.
Have you seen the film?
I'm going to see it today, as I told you.
Ah, okay. Yes, that's right. During the pre-show. Well, I won't tell you how it ends. But what's remarkable to me is, even though we all know how it ends, it's a darn good film in that it just, the suspense is unbelievable. Now, the first thing I did after seeing the film, and I've seen it, well, 1.5 times, I saw half a screening and went to see it. In any case, I went and started to look up, okay, how much of this is actually accurate and actually true? And a lot of it is accurate. Now, you know, because it's a film, you take one or two or three different meetings, you have to put them into the same meeting.
But they captured the gist of it, yeah.
But I thought, okay, you know, Jessica Chastain plays this woman. Is this woman real? And apparently she is real. The lead character is real. She was recently passed over for a promotion because she's getting so much attention and because of her, well, people are a little surprised. And
she's a pain in the neck.
Yeah, she's a big pain in the neck, basically. But Chastain could not talk to her because, of course, she's an operative. She has no idea who she is. And the people who in the CIA who know her said, wow, you know, even without meeting her, she did a pretty good job of capturing her.
Well, there you go. So now that's an argument for the film. But would you think Zero Dark Thirty would have been better if it was shot in 3D? Do you miss the fact that it wasn't shot in 3D?
I'm thankful.
Are you laughing at the suggestion that it should have been shot in 3D?
Deep down inside, I'm laughing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, why is that?
Because...
Is 3D dead?
I don't think... I think 3D is like first-class travel. There's a small portion of the plane where people who can afford first class and who like to fly first class can go sit, but most of us are sitting in economy and in coach and in business class if we're lucky.
So you're willing to pay up for certain movies in 3D is what you're saying?
Exactly. Sometimes okay. You're taking a long trip.
Maybe but now studios thought that every movie was going to be in 3D, didn't they?
They
thought every film,
did.
Drama, comedy, you name it, every movie was automatically going to be in 3D, just like they're in color and they have a score.
They thought they definitely had the sense that it was moving that way. When you hear Jeffrey Katzenberg, the head of DreamWorks Animation, saying, well, gee, wouldn't The Queen have been good in 3D? Wouldn't The Departed have been good in 3D? He now takes that back and says, okay, maybe I was going a little too far there. But, you know, he says a lot of films would be good in 3D. You have Life of Pi.
And that's
in
not
3D.
True anymore.
That's not true anymore. I mean, I think what they're seeing is leveled off. People's curiosity is over. I was, I spend this week going to see a lot of movies that I've already seen before at screenings. I go and see them in the theater because I want to see what it's like with an audience. And I watched a mother and child walk up to the movie theater to see a film, and I can't even remember what it was, Rise of the Guardians or The Hobbit. And she said, oh, it's only showing in 3D and you don't like 3D. And the child was probably like 10 years old.
Right.
And I thought, oh, that's interesting.
So the BBC has an article. It says, is 3D dead? And they say, to a degree, yes. The idea that every film will be shot in 3D, that is completely dead. They say, and as far as artistically, they say Avatar was the high watermark, and nothing since then has really impressed, with perhaps the exception of Life of Pi, but certainly not to me. They talk to cinematographers, almost all of whom hate it. They say audiences are smarter and don't automatically flock to the 3D option. They say it does work well for animation. They say artistically, yes. Martin Scorsese, Werner Herzog, Wim Wenders, Ang Lee have all made serious films in 3D. And so there is a, you know, in the future, just like some films will be shot in black and white, someone says this movie must be in black and white. There's obviously from now until the end of time, the possibility that a director will say, this film needs to be in 3D. I want to shoot this in 3D. And there will be good artistic reasons for it. We can accept that. But the idea that almost every film is going to be 3D and people will happily pay for it, even every animated film, I don't think that's going to happen anymore. You know, that's the last bastion of 3D in a way. And I think, like you say, a lot of kids hate it. So I think really I think they're right that essentially as far as it being the big new standard, just like color and sound, forget about it.
Well, and then you have all these reissues. You got Star Wars. You have, well, just this week.
And that's over with.
That's over with. Well, not over. They'll still probably do it now and again, but they certainly won't expect it to make $100 million the way The Lion King did.
Yeah. Monsters, Inc. was a total flop. And somebody said, well, but that's not one of the big Pixar movies. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's basically tied for third all time in all the Pixar films. You have Toy Story 3, you have Finding Nemo, and then essentially tied for third are Monsters, Inc. and The Incredibles.
Yeah, so you're talking about Dave Hollis, who's the president of theatrical distribution, and he said the most important drivers are the timelessness of the story and the characters. They appeal across multiple generations and an opportunity to meet a demand in the family market. We remain very judicious about our choices and continue to refine our offerings as we learn about what drives consumers to these special engagements. Now,
in other words, we won't do that again.
Well, and what he means by judicious and about choices and continue to refine is we'll release all of them again.
No, he doesn't. He means the opposite of that.
Well, we'll see. I mean,
this was a commercial flop for them. They lost money on this.
I've got to be honest with you. I don't know how they marketed this movie, but I didn't even know it was being released. I knew it was being released eventually. I didn't know it was being released this December. I thought it was next March.
And they really didn't have any competition because Rise of the Guardians had come out like 4 weeks earlier. There were not a lot of good family options. So this movie had the field wide open to itself. It couldn't have asked for a better holiday option. You know, it really, if it was going to work, it could have been huge.
Yeah, well, it didn't.
But no, I don't think he's saying we're going to re-release it. He's saying we're going to be more judicious, which means, yeah, we're not going to make the same mistake as much. We're not going to be, don't wait for The Incredibles in 3D.
Well, and then you have people who are on the opposite side of the fence, Michael, and some of them are pretty important. You got Queen Elizabeth II of the United Kingdom. She said, well, she, I guess, did her annual Christmas and holiday speech in 3D.
Just proves how uncool 3D has become. Well, if the queen's doing it, it's like if she starts to rap, you don't want to rap anymore. That was cute, but pointless because nobody could see it in 3D. How many people in England have 3D televisions? Four.
Well, you know, she
maybe five. Maybe Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah. Well, you know, her inauguration was shot in 3D.
No, it was not.
Yeah, not. Did I say inauguration? Her coronation. Sorry. Was shot in 3D.
Her coronation was not shot in 3D.
Yes, it was. Look it up. 1954, I believe. And they recently found it, like, in the past 5 years, they found the footage.
You're kidding me. That's hilarious.
Yeah, and it was color and in 3D.
She's like, what took you so long?
Yeah, go figure.
Well, but, and that's point. And again, what a great example of a fad. That her coronation was shot in 3D, as if who cares? Who could see it in 3D? Nobody. No, well, and, you know, not at home. They obviously went to theaters and put on 3D glasses. I assume it was shown in British theaters that could adapt to those, you know, blue, green, red, green glasses. But now she shot it for people in the homes who can't even watch it in 3D. So it's even stupider than it was back then.
Well, I'm not sure if there will be any 3D films nominated for Best Picture this year. Maybe Life of Pi. Maybe.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Maybe The Hobbit, although highly unlikely.
Not The Hobbit. The Hobbit.
Either way, if they are nominated, whoever nominated them had to jump through hoops to do so if they decided to do it electronically. We've talked in the past about how the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has moved to e-voting for the annual Oscars. And we thought, oh, this is a good idea. You can vote from anywhere in the world and, you know, online. But when you can do that, there's, you know, that ever present problem of access versus security.
Well, it's not a big problem. We all have bank accounts and we access them online. It shouldn't be that difficult for them to create a system that's relatively secure. I mean, for God's sakes.
Well, apparently
I do banking
is.
Online. They make it sound like they have to be, you know, ready to be there. And the CIA gets hacked. So you're going to get hacked, right? The Pentagon gets hacked. So the Academy can't say, well, we're not going to get hacked. They have to anticipate this is going to happen and prepare for it. The problem mainly is that their average age of their Academy members is 70.
No, it's 60. It's 62. But
well,
yeah.
62. I'm joking. 62 is really old. So when these people, a lot of these people don't have computers. They really don't barely use email. So they don't. It's complicated. And they can't handle it.
One of the people that Scott Feinberg of The Hollywood Reporter spoke to when he was doing this story on the problems faced by the e-voting, the Oscar e-voting, one commenter said, listen, I don't do anything online. You know, I don't even have a computer. I'm writing my next book in longhand with drawings and notebooks. And that particular voter he chose a paper ballot.
Sure. So here's the problem. They sent out information in letters that look like junk mail. People tried to log in online and couldn't log in. They tried several times. They didn't let people see the password they were typing in. So they weren't sure if they were doing upper and lowercase. They weren't sure what they typed in. So they didn't know what they did wrong. So once you did it three times, then you got locked out. So then you had to call the hotline. Then they said it took 24 hours for you to get booted back up again. And then it still didn't work. And when you got in there, even if you logged in successfully, people found it really confusing to handle. It wasn't apparently a very simple, easy, you know, website. So with all those problems, a lot of people are throwing up their hands in disgust and saying, well, I'm just not going to vote. And they anticipate this might be one of the lowest years of voting in a long time.
Right. Yeah, that's the big concern. What came in the mail was a voter identification number, which you then had to enter in the website to get your password. So it was like a two-step process.
And you had
process.
To have a second password because they already have a password, but you couldn't use that for some reason here. They wanted you to have a second password to vote.
Well, it's a security measure called two-step authentication. So it's very common. You know, banks do it. You know, Bank of America does it when you log in. There's two-step authentication. And you know, Google does it for Gmail if you'd like. You don't have to turn that on. But yeah, I think the big concern is that some people just throw up their hands and go, you know what? Forget it.
So this means younger voters might have more sway, which means you can anticipate perhaps movies like Django Unchained doing better than they might have otherwise.
I guess we'll know when.
How will this affect voting? It could affect voting. And here's one of the things. They're worried about being hacked. They're worried about somebody breaking in and suddenly Adam Sandler wins Best Actor. What they don't seem to have anticipated is something as simple as a paper ballot or as a paper record. You know, when you go to a voting booth, I want to be able to print out a paper record and see that there's a physical record of what I voted for, president, vice president, whatever. I don't feel good unless there is that paper trail. And I want to be able to look at it and know that it's accurate. So in my ballot, I filled out a bubble sheet and then they fed it into the computer. So I knew my bubble sheet was accurate. And that's a secondary backup to the electronic voting. So if something goes wrong or they suspect or they need to recount, they have my physical ballot that they can go to. And I know that that's accurate and has my number on and all that stuff. Well, here we are at the Academy. Why not send people a self-addressed stamped envelope? They vote online, and then you press print, and it prints out their ballot with their code, their ID number, their account number, whatever it is, and they mail that in. So then if there's an issue, or they want to double check, or people want to make sure that you have a physical record of what they actually voted for, and you want to make sure someone hasn't changed all the votes, well, there you've got that physical record. You know, one vote, one ballot, mail it in, then they've got your account number. There it is. No, you didn't vote for Adam Sandler. You voted for Christoph Waltz.
Right. Right. Although, wouldn't it be fun to see Adam Sandler win?
It would be great.
Now, that is a good solution for, security.
Well, it's
for
security, yeah. Just another
but
step
you
that
still
they
have
should
to
do.
You still have to be able to get into the site to vote on the first place.
So they messed it up.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go. You know who else messed up is Forbes.
I know. I could see in the show notes that we put together each week, you just took them to task for saying that Natalie Portman was the most bankable movie star in the world.
Right. Forbes magazine, I guess I should say Forbes.com, came up with a list of the most bankable stars of Hollywood.
Now, how did they do this? What was the criteria for saying this was a
bankable? They looked at only the last three films that the actors starred in, which means no supporting turns, no big ensembles. I'm not sure how they would decide that, and no animated films.
So I guess they really did take to heart what a lot of people say in Hollywood, which is you're only as good as your last film.
Right, exactly. But of course, when you use such a small sample size, you're going to get a very skewed idea of who is successful. Then they looked at their salary versus box office, and then they ranked them according to the biggest bang for the buck, meaning you paid them the least amount of money, and they made you the most money at the box office.
Okay.
So they came up with a list of the most bankable stars in Hollywood. They are Natalie Portman, Kristen Stewart, Shia LaBeouf, Robert Pattinson, Daniel Radcliffe, and Taylor Lautner. Those are the top six.
Are you kidding me?
Now you look at it and you go, that doesn't make any sense, but gee, three of those are in the Twilight movies. In other words, they should have said this is a list of the people in the big franchises. Shia LaBeouf is in Transformers. Natalie Portman was in Black Swan. That was why she got successful, because she happened to be in a movie where she cost nothing to make and made a ton of money worldwide. And then it was balanced out by No Strings Attached, which actually did okay, and Your Highness, a stoner comedy, which was a flop. She returned, they claim, $42.70 for every $1 you paid her. Nevertheless, if you look at Natalie Portman's entire career, she's filled with films that are box office failures except for Star Wars. She's got a few hits, but they're few and far between. So if you look at her career in any sort of context, there's no way she would say she's even one of the top 10 or 20 most bankable stars of Hollywood. It's crazy. Kristen Stewart had Twilight and Snow White and the Huntsman. That's why she's ahead of Robert Pattinson and Taylor Lautner, but they're still in the top six because they're all in the Twilight movies. Never mind that none of them essentially are box office draws in any other movie.
Bradley Cooper here is in at number seven, probably for The Hangover.
Right, he's for The Hangover 2. And he's in there for The Hangover 2. And again, Dwayne Johnson doesn't have a very good track record here. He's in the top 10. Amy Adams is in the top 10. Amy Adams is one of the top 10 bankable stars in Hollywood. So that's just, if you look at what they did, it's just asinine. Limited to three films, not distinguishing between people who are in a franchise and people who are the actual draw of a movie. Obviously, 5 years ago, Daniel Radcliffe was the biggest bankable star in Hollywood, as opposed to a young actor who has talent and is lucky to be in a really big franchise. Martin Freeman is Money in the Bank. My God, he's at, next year he will have been in The Hobbit and The Hobbit Part 2. He'll be the biggest bankable star in Hollywood. I predict it now. I mean, that's how stupid this is. It has nothing to do. Three movies is too small a set to make, comparisons on.
Well, I don't even know why we're talking about it then.
Well, because it's in Forbes magazine and it will get repeated all over the web.
Oh, okay. Well,
and
you know,
it's bad statistics, bad math, bad science, however you want to qualify it. And if you think about who's actually a bankable star and name people like Tom Cruise and Will Smith and Sandra Bullock and Denzel Washington, you go look at their track record. Those are stars. You look at the movies they made and the consistency and how time after time they bring people out to the theaters. And even when you have a movie that's not a success, they guarantee you a certain level of audience draw so that your movies are not going to be a massive failure. And that's really the big difference for a star. It's not that they're going to guarantee you a hit every time, but they're going to guarantee you a certain base audience so that your movies will not be out-and-out flops, so that they'll have a certain value on DVD and cable and TV and around the world. And that makes them bankable because you put them in your movie, you've got a seller. You've got a baseline of success that you're going to reach, unless it's 1 out of 100, that they're going to get you a certain level of audience no matter what. Even if it is a bad film, their fans will show up. And that's really the importance of a star. Not the fact that they're going to give you hits every time, but they'll protect you from massive financial losses.
Well, it's an insurance policy. Now, right. If anything, I'm just glad we talked about this because we get to mention Bradley Cooper, who is in what I think is one of the best films of the year, and that is Silver Linings Playbook.
Right, and this movie cost $21 million to make. I think it's made $27 million at the box office. Is that where it's at right now?
I guess so, yeah, I think so.
So that's not bad. You know, it's still got a lot of, yeah, it's made $27 million. It cost $21 million to make, and that's a good price. You know, this is a labor of love. It's for actors like, you know, him and Jennifer Lawrence and Robert De Niro trying to make a movie with director David O. Russell, who made Three Kings, one of my favorite films, and I actually liked it more than I expected. It's not one of my favorites of the year, but I liked it. And it's a success story. You know, they're not going to lose their money. It still hasn't turned into a hit. It really needs Oscar nominations to become a commercial success.
Yeah, I agree.
But they're
with
clearly
that.
Not going to lose their shirt. But you look at that, and you look at the Parental Guidance starring Billy Crystal and Bette Midler. Now, they say that movie cost $25 million to make.
On what
planet?
And
I thought, how the heck could that be?
Yeah.
But then I read that it said that they deferred their salaries in exchange for cut deals.
Yeah.
Now, explain to us what a cut deal is.
A cut deal is you're getting a cut of the movie.
And I assume that's a cut of the gross, because they're not going to take a cut of the net, obviously.
Yeah, of course, how do you determine the gross when all of a sudden, you know...
You determine the gross by looking at Hollywood Reporter. What do you mean?
Yeah, well, there's usually some way to measure it that is public. And the Hollywood Reporter or RentTrack or Hollywood.com, which is basically pulling from RentTrack, becomes that marker. It's very hard to get a deal like that. However, the reason you do that is you're basically making all the stars participate and invest in your movie.
And then they want to promote it and they want to talk about it. And it's cheaper to make. So if you lose money, it's only $25 million rather than $50 or $60 or $70
million. That's right.
Right. And Billy Crystal and Bette Midler obviously are not the same draws that they were once upon a time. But, you know, if they get a cut of the gross, then again, it's going to be a lot harder for you to get to profitability.
Right. I mean, so what you're saying is that this film, Parental Guidance, it's not going to be, you know, 50 years from now, 20 years from now, picked by the National Film Registry as one of the films that should be put in the archive there at the Library of Congress.
Well, they do that every year. And who knows? Because they pick some films I would find suspect it's not just artistic merit. The National Film Registry, which is preserves films for the Library of Congress, and not even preserves them, I shouldn't say that. They nominate them to a list of movies that deserve preservation, because it doesn't mean you'll actually be preserved. I found that out this year. But if you get nominated to this list, and that means you are culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. Clearly, Parental Guidance would never be aesthetically significant, but somehow it might indicate some cultural or historical relevance. I doubt it, but it happens. But the list did come out. Did you look at it?
I did look at it, and Dirty Harry, A League of Their Own, I was surprised.
Me too. That's one that was there for historical reasons. They say this movie, A League of Their Own, directed by Penny Marshall, revealed the role of women in sports, an unknown chapter of American history, and also showed the changing role of women during wartime, World War II in this case, also a chapter of history that perhaps is underrepresented in film. And for that reason, they decided it was significant enough to include on the list.
Dirty Harry. Did I say Dirty Harry? I guess I did. A Christmas Story. I was happy to see A Christmas Story in there. I thought that was, you know, it's a great film.
Return to Yuma, one of my favorite films of all time.
1957 version.
Yes, of course. Not the remake, but the 57 original. That'll be high on my list of the best films of the 1950s.
Breakfast at Tiffany's, I think I mentioned already, or maybe I didn't, but Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Right, Slacker, a Laurel and Hardy film, The Times of Harvey Milk, a great documentary. I actually have issues with Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Oh, okay. Do you not like Eggs Over Easy? Or
you can see with some other films that they've explained why the movie is there, its significance culturally, historically. If they said Breakfast at Tiffany's was there not just because it's beloved by some people, but because it has this ugly facet to it, which is Mickey Rooney's performance in Yellowface. He plays an Asian neighbor of Audrey Hepburn. It's literally skin-crawlingly embarrassing. It's just, you can't believe it's in the film. And I think if they'd said, look, this movie is here, it has a beloved performance by Audrey Hepburn, but it also is one of the last Hollywood movies to have Yellowface in it, meaning a white actor playing an Asian character. And the fact that this was a practice incredibly common throughout Hollywood. You'd had Charlie Chan movies and they never starred an Asian. they start a Swede, they start anybody but an Asian. You had films throughout Hollywood history where Asian actors were portrayed negatively or not at all, or by people
but
who were
not
Asian.
But they didn't say this. They didn't say it at all.
Right, they didn't say it. If they'd said this film was notable as one of the last examples of a major Hollywood film with this execrable practice and how it showed how far we came that this practice died out, but also the fact that people love and embrace this film despite this embarrassing facet to it indicates how far perhaps we still have to go. If they'd said all of that, I might accept the movie being listed there, but they didn't, and I find that a shame. They sort of ignored it's the one really historically significant thing about the movie, this shameful and embarrassing practice.
Well, you know, I'm just glad that a movie like Kodachrome Color Motion Picture Tests gets in, because, you know, that is really historically significant.
Well, there's a number of oddball films. We have a link to the entire list. And I love the offbeat choices that sort of illuminate a part of film history. Not just Hollywood history, but film history, stuff that isn't known about. The Kodachrome Color Motion Picture Test was a demo reel that I forget which was it Kodak at the time? They
yes.
made a demo reel to show the film industry, look what a color movie could be like.
That's
and
right.
So they got these people, they dressed them up, and they said, hey, look at color. Isn't it amazing? They were trying to convince Hollywood you need to switch to color. And so it's this test reel that everybody in Hollywood saw. Of course, we've never heard of it, but it is certainly historically significant. And there's a number of interesting sort of offbeat side notes in those list of movies that aren't well-known Hollywood films. There's Parable, which is a regional Christian film. We've talked a lot in recent years about movies made regionally by Christian groups to sort of promote Christian ideals and Christian storylines, and they get released four-walled around the country and make a lot of money, relatively speaking, but they're sort of completely out of the Hollywood focus. Well, this has been going on for a long time, apparently. This one was made back in 1964 and was exhibited at the World's Fair and was controversial and hugely popular, both for liberal and conservative denominations. It depicts Jesus as a clown at a circus. And some people hated it because they thought it was, you know, disrespectful. Other people loved it. And it's sort of an interesting early example of that trend of making a movie just for your particular audience, whether it's a black audience or an Asian audience or a Christian audience, saying Hollywood doesn't represent us and we're going to make our own movie. Well, it didn't just start in the 80s or 90s when you had cheap videos. It began a long time ago, apparently.
Well, and there's I know you wanted to talk about the Kidnapper's foil.
Oh, this is really cool, too. Apparently, film companies would go around the country for decades from the 1930s to the 50s, and they knew there was a business for this. They knew people loved to see themselves on TV, of course, on film, just like they do today. And what they would do is they'd come to a town with like a mock script. They'd have a standard script that they would use for like a 20-minute short. And they would hold auditions and get lots of free publicity and cast local kids and local people in the film, but mostly kids, apparently. And so they put kids in these roles, and this storyline, apparently, this particular one, was about a birthday party where a kid gets kidnapped and then gets rescued by their friends. And so they would make this 20-minute film, get all this publicity and all this attention from the town. Everybody get excited. They'd have auditions, and oh, press would go crazy. And then like 2 or 3 months later, whenever they finished printing the film, they'd go back to town and they would show the movie. Then, of course, everyone in town went to see it because, my God, there they were on screen. And I think they were pretty smart about choosing kids from different neighborhoods and different ethnic groups to make sure they reached out to the rich, to the poor, to, you know, they had kids from all over the town in all the different areas so they get everybody into the theater. And this apparently was a very successful business. The Kidnapper's Foil is one example by one company, but apparently a number of firms went around the country doing this all the time for decades.
And did they ever discover like a real movie star? Like, you know,
I don't know. I haven't heard about that, but that's certainly a possibility. They'd say, hey, you actually have talent, kid. That'd be a great little movie, though, watching these people go town to town making these junky little films and suddenly finding a kid who actually had talent. I've just made a film pitch. And then they want to make a real movie after years of making this crappy little, you know. But there you go. A fascinating little corner of Hollywood history.
Well, you know, if you just made a film pitch, you know what a studio executive would say.
Give me another one.
What else do you got?
What else do you got? They call it Pro Football. This is an early film by NFL Films, which was a private firm that ultimately merged with or became bought out by the NFL itself. And they were a family. There was a great article in The New Yorker a few months ago. I couldn't find the article. I need to look for it.
Well, you know why? Because the person who shot most of and I'm forgetting his name now, I'm blanking, but he passed away recently.
Well, they had a great article about the family and him in The New Yorker and elsewhere, a couple articles. I think there was one in Rolling Stone as well, but a really interesting article about this family and all the innovations they did on sports filming. They really set the tone for sports documentary, you know, another leap forward beyond Olympiad and some early films made by Leni Riefenstahl and the Tokyo Olympics. These guys really brought the way we see football today is the way they started filming it in 1967. All the innovations that they did are really notable, and you can see them in a million different ways, both in live sports broadcasting and the documentaries made about them. And They Call It Pro Football is on the list because it's indicative of the innovative work that they did. Unlike some of these other films that we've talked about in this sort of offbeat category, this one actually has aesthetic value as well as being incredibly influential throughout television and filmmaking.
Well, we're running a little long, so why don't we jump ahead here to theater, the theater news, because you wanted to tell us how Chicago, which I like to call my kind of town, but apparently it's also a musical, it has some big news this past week.
Well, on December 20th, it became the third longest running show in Broadway history, passing Les Mis, the original production of Les Mis. And ironically enough, just as Les Mis hits the movie theaters, Chicago passes it up on the list of all-time productions. So it's now third on the list. It's Phantom of the Opera, which is still running. It's been there. It'll be there 25 years in January. Cats, which ran for more than 7,400 performances. And now at number three is Chicago, which is at 6,681 as of December 20th and counting. That just passes Les Mis. And below that, The Lion King, which is still running. A Chorus Line, O Calcutta, Beauty and the Beast, Rent, and Mamma Mia, which is also still running, but probably on its deathbed.
Oh, wow.
I'm not being mean. It ran for 4,600 performances. It's one of the 10 longest running shows in Broadway history. You shouldn't gasp when I say I think its time is about up. Kind of interestingly, four of the top 10 longest running shows in Broadway history are on Broadway right now. And seven of the top 25 are currently running.
Well, do you think that at some point in the future, that Newsies, which is, I guess, based on a Disney movie, but now it's a Broadway musical, do you think that might join this list of dignified...
Top 10? No way.
No?
No, not the top 10. I mean, that's one in a gazillion.
Well,
I don't think Newsies will last that long. It's already faded a little bit.
Okay.
Once it's doing a little bit better than it. It took a little hit since Jeremy Jordan, but it is a hit. It's doing well. It's going to run for 2 or 3 years, and that'll make it. It could make the top 100 list of all time, but it'll have to run for 3 years to do that. But it's possible. You know, it's certainly a big Broadway success. But
and it's in the black now. It's profitable.
That's right. It made money. It's the fastest show to make money in Disney history. They started with Beauty and the Beast, of course. Then they had Aida and Little Mermaid and this and that. And, of course, The Lion King is their monster hit. They have Mary Poppins on Broadway right now. I think that's in the top 25. So they've had a lot of success on Broadway. They were sort of hated and feared when they began. And now they're a big part of the establishment, and everybody loves them. And Newsies is a big success story for them. I guess it tells you that kids come cheap. You want to make a profitable show, cast a bunch of kids because they don't get good money.
Well, and if you're taking your kids to New York, you got to have something to show them. They'll take them to a Disney show.
There's a lot of options. There's The Lion King is still there, and Wicked for little girls and
boys.
Yeah. And Newsies. But yeah, Newsies and Annie is on Broadway right now. And in the spring comes, what's that show? Matilda. Matilda?
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
The Roald Dahl book. That's coming. So there's been a big family audience. And as we realized last week or a couple weeks ago, over 60% of Broadway audience are women.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
Women and families dominate Broadway.
Well, I can guarantee you wouldn't be taking your kid to see Dead Accounts, but now you can't take your kid to see Dead Accounts, which is this Teresa Rebeck play. And I guess it had only 27 previews and 44 regular performances, starred Katie Holmes, and guess what? It's shutting down.
Well, it's not Katie Holmes' fault. It wasn't a very good play, and she was not the problem. So, you know, plays come and go. That's not hardly a crazy or doesn't reflect poorly on Katie Holmes. Not at all. In fact, she got pretty polite reviews. I'd say she was actually pretty good. I mean, given her lack of experience, she was fine.
Okay, well then, given that, would it make your top list of shows for this year, 2012?
No, it wasn't a good show.
Oh, okay. Well, what would make what is your list of top shows for 2012?
Well, we've got the full list on the website. You can check it out. I wrote up a long piece for Huffington Post. But my number favorite show of the year was Einstein on the Beach, a revival that actually two friends of mine were deeply involved in. One works for the company that works with Philip Glass. The other one was involved in the casting. I've been a huge fan of Philip Glass all my life. He's been a touchstone. I've written about him or interviewed him for every outlet I've ever worked for, from Premier Magazine, from my college newspaper to Premier Magazine to the New York Post, the New York Daily News, Huffington Post, you name it. I've almost always written about or interviewed Philip Glass for those publications. So I'm a huge fan of Einstein on the Beach. I'd only seen it once in my life because it was never filmed. So the chance to see it again, and I saw it twice in 1 week, it was just overwhelming. And it was a great, great production. So I just absolutely loved it. And it's still touring around the world. So if you're rich and you can get there, go find out where it's at and check it out.
Why do you have to be rich? Just because you have to get there?
Well, if you live in the States and want to go to Hong Kong to see the production of the show, you got to be rich. Unless you live in Hong Kong, it's a lot of money to go fly to Hong Kong just to see a show.
That's true.
But there's a lot of great shows, a couple good plays, As You Like It, free play at Shakespeare in the Park, but it was a tremendous production. Tribes, a great play that was downtown. This was a play about a young man who's hearing challenged, living in a hearing family, but it was a very rich, good play. The best new musical I saw this year was Giant. That was at the Public. It's based on the book by Edna Ferber that was turned into a big film starring Rock Hudson, Elizabeth Taylor, and James Dean. Great musical. I really hope it comes to Broadway, but it had a brief limited run at the Public. And then there's some other shows on there, but, you know, check out the list and see what there is.
And the reason we bring you a list like this or talk about shows like this is because, and we do get from time to time an email or two saying, why are you guys talking about Broadway shows when, you know, your audience is all over the world? And that is true. We try to focus on the shows that might travel.
Well, so, Ice on the Beach is traveling around the globe. Tribes was certainly been produced in the UK and will be produced elsewhere. Porgy and Bess is on the road right now. Daniel Kitson is on my list. He's a great British comic. He does stand-up, and he also does live theater, these sort of in-depth stories that he tells. It's not a monologue a la Spalding Gray, but he certainly travels, certainly in the UK and the US. Clybourne Park has been seen all over the world. The Piano Lesson is August Wilson. Pigpen is a great company. They're off Broadway right now. It's closing in a few days, The Old Man and the Old Moon. But they have an album out, and they're going to be touring the country. So if you're not in New York and you're interested in Pigpen, they play great Americana music a la Mumford & Son. We have a link to their website. They are going to tour the U.S., so maybe they'll be coming to your neighborhood. And Once, of course, is still on Broadway. So if people are coming to New York and you want to see a show, you know, that's a great Broadway show to see.
And let's face it, that will be traveling.
Oh, absolutely. That will be touring. But it's also, you know, a lot of people come to New York for live theater. So hopefully they'll keep that in mind. I think if they went to it and they liked it, it would be a big deal.
Okay, I see what you're trying to do. You're trying to move us right along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. Okay, we all know The Walking Dead would be renewed. We all knew that. But it's quite a shock to find out that showrunner Glenn Mazzara is leaving the show over creative differences. The zombie drama took bold but expected steps in season 3, killing off more main characters, which keeps it in line with the comic book it is based on and thrilled both critics and fans. Ratings are at an all-time high, and the money is pouring in. Mazzara's success justified AMC firing the show's original creative force, which was director Frank Darabont, who had pushed back when AMC cut the budget for the biggest hit any basic cable channel has ever had. They tried to cut back the budget. They did cut back the budget, and he tried to fight it. But now Mazzara is leaving because he and AMC disagreed on what direction the show should go in. Sons of Anarchy creator Kurt Sutter joined a chorus of disapproval from the creative community, tweeting, AMC is run by small-minded, bottom-line thinkers who have no appreciation or gratitude for the effort of its creative personnel. I wonder what he really thinks. Sutter is a friend of Mazzara's. They worked together on The Shield. Damon Lindelof, also, who you probably know from Lost, well, he tweeted, The Walking Dead is to showrunners as Spinal Tap is to drummers. I'm not really sure what that means, but Big Deal or Big Whoop.
I think it's a very big deal. I can't believe this happened. I'm stunned. I still don't know the reason why, but the fact that they're firing him now, what do they think, that it doesn't matter who runs the show?
Well, yeah, you know, what's interesting is that here's a network, AMC, that came out of nowhere and started doing some very creative work. They have The Walking Dead. They have
Mad Men. Breaking Bad.
Yeah, all of this great work, Hell on Wheels. And it's being seen as a place to go, like HBO is, and, well, I was going to say was, but it still is, a place to go with some, you know, to be really...
That's where you want to be.
Yeah. And what are they doing? They're slowly killing their soldiers. It's not a very smart move on their part.
It's an incredibly dumb move. Why do you want to have a reputation for being horrible for the creative community when that's all you have going for you is the idea that you'd be a great place for the creative community to create great work? It's insane. They should be firing the head of AMC and, you know, replacing him, not Mazzara, because not only did he take over the show and keep it going, he made it even better and, you know, made it, it's still growing as a hit. This is the biggest hit on television, and they're firing the guy? That's idiotic. There's no conceivable. If he's eating small babies on the set, you say, can we get you some more? I mean, you just, it's a hit. What are you doing? I don't get it.
Well, okay. Let's move on then.
Because, is that a bit much?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Elvis spottings.
That is how Hollywood works, though.
From baby eating to Elvis spottings, which may be rare outside of tabloids like Weekly World News, but spottings of forged Elvis Presley autographs are a lot more common. That's according to PSA DNA, a firm which specializes in authenticating autographs of celebrities. They've compiled two lists for 2012, the most forged celebs and the most forged athletes. Boy, they are really trying to market themselves with this, aren't they? Dead people top both of them. Elvis is number one, with the Beatles at number two, Neil Armstrong at number three, and Michael Jackson at number four.
Isn't that cheating? Because the Beatles are four people.
Yeah, I guess.
Okay.
Under athletes, the Sultan of SWAT, Babe Ruth, is still number one after all these years, followed by Lou Gehrig, Mickey Mantle, and then Michael Jordan. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
Okay, moving on then.
People are faking autographs. I have an album signed by Bing Crosby, but I don't think it really was. I bought it at a trade show and it had his signature on. I go, that's not real. As he goes, I don't know, which means it's not.
Plenty of stories about bookstores will say that independents are doing okay. They're benefiting from the closure of borders and the introduction of e-readers that they can sell and get a cut of digital sales and especially the loyalty of customers. One store owner described all the customers who showed up unbidden during Hurricane Sandy and offered to help carting books to their homes and then bringing them back when the floodwaters had receded. Author, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, is it Juno Diaz?
I think it's Juno, but perhaps it is
Juno.
Juno
Diaz speaks up about a favorite bookstore of his while they are soliciting contributions to keep the store open. So is Books of Wonder. Of course, I know Books of Wonder even all the way here on the left coast. It's a venerable children's bookstore in Manhattan that did everything one could ask of an indie. It specialized in a genre, and that genre, of course, is children's books. It offered rare and first editions. It ran all sorts of events, and a cafe and a bakery was on the premises. But if indies are doing okay, why do they have to ask for contributions to stay open? And, you know, is this trend a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal in a negative sense. I mean, they're becoming nonprofits. Because,
yeah.
We've got loyal customers who are willing to spend money to see us stay open. Well, that's not a business. That's a nonprofit.
That's a charity.
So they're unprofitable. Okay. Now they want to be nonprofitable. That's the only way for them to survive, I guess. It's a very sad sign.
Remember how we explained that people may be buying 3D-compatible TVs, but by and large, they're not really using them to watch 3D TV programming. Do you remember when we talked about that?
I do.
Well, a new study makes the same point about so-called smart TVs. Those are the TVs that are ready to connect to the internet and let you check your email and go shopping and listen to music and watch movies and so on, all via the internet. Wired Magazine says a new study by the research firm NPD finds that more than 85% of people who own smart TVs have never done anything with it other than watch TV. In fact, almost half of them haven't even done the one thing you'd expect, use their smart TVs to access more TV via Netflix, Hulu Plus, and the like. There are lots of reasons for this, but Wired boils all of this information down to this. No one uses internet TV because it sucks. Big deal or big whoop?
Watch your language. Yes, I think it's a good point. I think it's a big deal. It shows how poor a job they are doing selling smart TV. It doesn't make any sense, really. I think one of the ideas was that if you had smart TVs, that they would get outmoded quicker. I think this is one of the secret ideas of them, that if you loaded up all the stuff that made them smart TVs, rather than giving just a great monitor to people and let them update their set-top box or their Roku or whatever it might be, if the smart TV itself was loaded with the newest stuff, then maybe it would become outmoded every 3 or 4 years and people would replace it just like they do their phones and their computers. And people say, no, I don't want to buy a TV every 3 years. I want to buy one once a decade. Thank you very much. I think this is one of the backdoor reasons why they've been pushing this, even though it doesn't really make a lot of sense. And who the heck wants to surf the internet on their television anyway? It's stupid.
Yes, I agree. Well, now, we just got this in from the No Duh department. Apparently, an academic study done by scholars in Liverpool says rock and roll really can kill you.
Oh, my God.
They looked at the lifespan of people who become famous from, they became famous between 1956 to 2006, from Elvis Presley to the Arctic monkeys and compared them to similar people in the general population. And the result? Rock and rollers really do die young, though not always at 27. In fact, the average age of death, notwithstanding, was, I guess, what, 45? Yes, 45 in the U.S. and 39 in Europe. Solo artists were more likely to die young than members of a band. Spinal Tap, of course, notwithstanding. People who... What is the deal with Spinal Tap this week? People who remained famous for 25 years or more began to trend back towards the average age of mortality for their group. So Keith Richards might actually be all right after all. One possibility is that rockers also experience more adverse circumstances in their youth that would make them prone to dying young, such as poverty, physical and sexual abuse. Others say just the torment of being an artist can drive you mad. So, big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
Okay.
Lame academic study?
Well, you know,
how do they decide who's famous? What if you're sort of semi-famous? What if you're just in a band but it's not a big hit? Maybe that helps you live longer. Right? It's just a silly, vague thing that barely constitutes academia. You know, barely constitutes science. It's just BS.
Okay.
How could you define it? How could you compare it? Who you're comparing them to? It's just crazy. What decides what level of fame it constitutes fame? You know, what if you have one hit? I think having one big hit, one number one hit, is probably worse than having 10 top 50 hits. You know what I mean?
Good
you
point.
You have one massive success, this probably messes you up more than having a string of small hits that did pretty well and yet never made you a huge superstar. It's just such a vague thing. It's silly.
Well, as I said, it came in from the no duh department, which just now, which is why I had trouble doing the read through. But
if you're rich and famous and running around the world all the time, yeah, you're going to be more likely to have a messed up life.
You know, I feel like I should read this next story in an accent.
Okay.
Another day, another chance for a court case to set precedent gone by the wayside. That's my Godfather voice. What do you think?
Not bad.
Okay, well, Paramount and the Mario
Puzo.
Not
good, but not bad.
You're saying I probably shouldn't play Jean Valjean?
Probably not.
Just checking. You know, as I was just about to say, Paramount, we've talked about this before. Paramount and the Mario Puzo estate, they've been fighting, and they have settled, though, this big, you know, all these lawsuits they had against one another. Paramount had sued the estate for publishing a sequel novel to The Godfather. The estate countersued and said, hey, you know what? The entire contract was now null and void, all right? A judge ruled that the fight over the novel, which was published to poor reviews and even poorer sales, wasn't at the heart of the contract and would not permit the contract to be voided. Seeing that, the estate and the studio came to terms and everyone is pretty much unhappy. Except the lawyers. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's a shame. There are a lot of Hollywood cases like this that we really hope go to trial, because they could settle precedent and they could settle some issues that are outstanding. But whenever it comes to net profits or contracts from the 60s and how they apply to new media, time and time again, everyone settles before it gets to trial because the studios are afraid to go to trial. They don't want to have some precedent set that goes against them. And the estate in this case saw that weren't in such a great shape. They weren't able to pretend the whole contract was a joke, even, you know, despite this fracas over a minor part of it. So they weren't able to get out of the main contract, so they didn't see any point in going forward and spending all the money, so they all settled. So yet another chance to sort of clear up what contracts in the 60s and how they apply to today is lost.
Well, you know, that's actually what our Inside Baseball story is for this week. And Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you, or in this case, how they'll affect screenwriters.
Well, this is sort of interesting. It's a lawsuit involving Emma Thompson, one of my favorite actresses, and of course, an Oscar-winning screenwriter
for her
adaptation of Sense and Sensibility.
That's right.
One of perhaps my favorite Jane Austen adaptation of all time. And, well, Pride and Prejudice, the TV miniseries.
I was going to say, that's a good, the miniseries from, I want to say, the BBC?
Well, yeah, Colin Firth. Yes. I don't know if it's the BBC, but it's certainly the UK.
Yes.
Yes, so she's delightful. And she was being sued by a playwright for a film that she made about Effie Gray. Effie Gray.
Watch your language, okay? Watch your
Not
language.
Not Effin Gray, but Effie Gray.
Oh, okay.
I had to look this up. Effie Gray was part of a notorious British scandal in the 1800s when divorce or even annulment was basically unheard of, especially in polite society. You just couldn't get a divorce. You couldn't even get an annulment. Didn't happen.
Yeah, of course. No, you just went out and had affairs. Everybody
That's
knows
right.
that.
Effie Gray was married to an art critic. And she was considered a beauty for her time, but for some reason, something about her person disgusted him, her husband, John Ruskin. and he refused to consummate the marriage.
Well, maybe that's because she was a woman, and, you know.
And that's not the case for him, as far as I can tell, because that didn't seem to be the issue. That's certainly across my mind. So 5 years later, they're still married. He still refuses to consummate the marriage because something about her disgusts him. And she falls in love with his protege, the painter John Everett Millais. I don't know if I'm saying that properly. She filed for an annulment, married the painter, and bore him 8 children.
What? This is a great story. Keep going.
Right, it's shocking indeed for its day. And of course, once she got the annulment, even she wasn't divorced. She just got an annulment, which meant the marriage never happened, technically. Ah. That's the idea behind an annulment. It's for people who are too ashamed to get a divorce. And so she had the annulment, but she could never be seen in polite society. She was a big society person, but she could never be in the company of Queen Victoria ever again because she'd gotten an annulment. She was a whore. She was a divorcee. It was scandalous. You couldn't be seen with the queen. So that was a pain in the neck. So that went on for much of her life, and eventually she was able to be seen in the presence of somebody in court, which helped her, you know, get back to good graces.
And we don't mean the court of law. We mean the court of the royal court.
The queen, right.
Yes.
Right. So this huge scandal, incredibly famous. It's already been turned into several plays and an opera, among other works of art. And Emma Thompson adapted the story, made a film. It stars Dakota Fanning as Effie, David Suchet of Poirot as Ruskin, the art critic, and heartthrob Tom Sturridge as the painter, which is hardly fair to poor David Suchet. But anyway, she makes this movie, and then this playwright, Eve Pomerantz, sues her and says, hey, you're ripping off my screenplay. And Emma's like, well, but it's public record, and I haven't looked at your screenplay, and I'm not, you know. She's like, no, but I've written two screenplays about this story, and I've copyrighted them, and this movie has too much in common with them.
Well, yeah, because it's based on historical fact.
Well, but it's a very complicated, interesting issue. So it went to trial, and there's a fairly famous case involving the Hindenburg movie starring George C. Scott. I think it's called The Hindenburg.
And apt name.
Yes. It was there was a nonfiction book about the Hindenburg that said it was basically blown up to humiliate Hitler. And this movie had that same idea. And the author said, hey, I discovered that. It was a nonfiction book. I came up with this theory. And the ruling, I'm probably messing this up, but the ruling in essence was, well, it's still part of the historical record. So even though it was a revelation and no one else had suggested it before, you can't copyright a historical event. You know, you say somebody assassinated Kennedy. Well, all right. Maybe you were the first one to come up with it, but you can't say it's all, you know. It was a very complicated case. And, you know, it sort of set a certain precedent. This case went to trial, went to federal court, all the way up to Judge J. Paul Otkin, who's actually the first openly gay judge to serve on the federal bench, strangely enough. No wonder he said Emma Thompson won. But anyway, he ruled on the case, and it's a very interesting ruling talking about the historic record and creativity and what can be considered part of the public record and where artistry comes into it. It's just a very interesting case as far as all the ramifications it has and you know, how it affects people who are writing about history. And, you know, it builds on that earlier case involving the Hindenburg. And it's a very, very interesting, well-written ruling. It's like 61 pages long, but I read the whole thing. It's fascinating, actually. So it will have a big effect on Hollywood and how people who are making movies. There's always competing movies about, you know, the Hindenburg or some historic figure.
Or there's like four movies about the Three Musketeers being made, or two about the Titanic being made. And yeah.
Yes. So in this case, it's films being made about a historic event. And no matter how obscure it is, that it's probably a little harder. It should be hard to insist that you have some sort of copyrightable take on that event. You know, you have to really have a very specific, unique approach to the story or something or other to distinguish it so that you could say it's copyrightable and someone else can't infringe on it. Because otherwise, you know, Oscar Wilde, how are you going to copyright a story about Oscar Wilde? Well, you have the three trials of Oscar Wilde, which builds on the public record and presents it all in a way that perhaps is artistically unique. Someone else could not copy that play and reproduce it and say, oh, I've got my own original play. How do you argue that? Because it's all public record. Nothing in that play is unique. It's all been edited in a unique manner. That's the argument that you make. But it is a very interesting realm of copyright law and legal cases. And I think anybody who's really interested into the law or copyright or creating works based on historical record might want to check it out.
You know, I'm thinking of writing a play and or screenplay of the congressional debate, which occurred in 1865, I believe, about the passage of the 13th Amendment.
Tony Kushner's going to sue your ass.
Oh, well, maybe I won't do that. He did, after all, speak at my college graduation. He was the keynote speaker. Probably shouldn't cross him. In any case, that moves us along to listener email, and we got a number of emails, but I'm going to point out one from Michelle Kasangian here, who sent in a link about the headline is Daft Punk, Phoenix, Yeah Yeah Yeahs, and Rolling Stones playing Coachella? ? Apparently Songkick, which is this website that lists concerts, sent out this email alerting fans of, you know, all of these bands are playing Coachella. Well, just she sent this in because we had talked about how the Rolling Stones' own iPhone app mentioned that they were playing Coachella in April of 2013. And now, less than a week later, you have this website letting even more information out ahead of time.
All before it's been officially announced by Coachella.
Right. And it was an accident. You know, 15 minutes later, it was taken down and, you know, somebody took a screenshot. And that's how it was noted here. But, you know.
So what's happening? Are people simply having automated systems set up, or they're not thinking about, you know, what happens when they go live, or what's going on here?
Well, I think that what's happening is one of two things. One, they are probably entering data ahead of schedule, which is done all the time. It's very common and actually necessary. And they either enter the wrong date, or it gets pushed out before, you know, by accident, or, you know, something happens that pushes the information that's in the database out to the public ahead of schedule. Or some developer who was trying to test things out had some test data. This happened to be it, and they accidentally pushed it out.
Whoops.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Michelle, for letting us know about that. That's kind of fun. And information wants out. Once people know, it's very hard to keep a lid on, even if you're trying to.
Right. And Michelle emailed us at dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Of course, you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our username is Showbiz Sandbox. That's our username over on Facebook, too, where you can like us, Showbiz Sandbox. So facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Now, you can find that information as well as links to all of the stories that we discussed in today's episode, as well as ways to follow us. You can subscribe to us anywhere they give out podcasts for free. You can rate and review the show on places like iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher. And we really do encourage you to subscribe and to rate and review the shows. All of this information can be found on our website, which is showbizsandbox.com. Pretty easy. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. It is
kimkardashian.com.
Wow. I did not know that.
I'm now dating Kanye West.
Okay. Well, you know, if you can't find some of Michael's work from, you know, any of his outlets, including the Huffington Post, on kimkardashian.com, try michaelgiltz.com. That's probably not a bad place to start. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.